and not an eternal account.
Tous du DDO, attention pour les décomptes finales. 10, 9, 8, 7.
It's morning launch, almost 3:30. And we're gonna make our fueling go or no go call soon.
Okay. Take it away, Rob. It's all yours.
Merry Christmas from the Guiana Space Center, where fueling of the vehicle is moments away while Webb systems are being carefully monitored for the momentous launch of the largest, most powerful telescope ever sent away from our planet.
It is the product of a feat of human ingenuity.
14 countries all working together.
We want to look back and see some of the very first stars and galaxies that were born in the early universe.
What we call cosmic dawn.
We have to accept the fact that we are in a risky business.
Everybody said if James Webb is unsuccessful, then NASA will never take on a big challenge again.
There's a little pond down here,
yeah,
as there still is, and used to come fishing here occasionally.
Well, I would like to tell you the entire story of the universe and a bit about how we learned about it and my personal part of this process and where we're going from here. And the title slide here says, from the Big Bang and on, etc., to the discovery of alien life. And so we haven't exactly found it yet, but I think it's possible in the next few decades. And so I want to outline at the very end how we are hoping to find out about that. So there are many, many mysteries.
I got interested in math and science when I was a little kid.
Here is a picture of the place where I grew up.
My dad was a scientist, but he studied dairy cows. I heard from him that people are made out of cells with chromosomes. I can remember I was about 6 years old and I'd heard about infinity. Well, that's pretty fascinating. So, okay, I want to know more about this. By 8 years old, I was reading Galileo and Darwin biographies and getting all the books about science I could get from the public library. I latched on pretty early. I knew when I got into the mission that it was going to be exciting. I said, this is the coolest thing that I've ever heard of. This is what I want to work on. And I do not care how hard it is or how long it's going to take. I just want to work on it and make it happen.
I love the feeling of awe, but then sharing that excitement with someone is then the next best feeling in the world.
It's super close, but it's not.
Oh, these two?
One of the things growing up in the city that we didn't really ever see was the sky. I do remember sort of one of these like core childhood memories is going up to Canada on a family vacation and my parents ushering me outside one night to look at the Milky Way. And I didn't understand what it was. And I was like, there's milk up there. They're like, no. That's our solar system. And we're looking up at all the stars that you wouldn't otherwise see. And I really didn't comprehend because I had no exposure to that prior in my life.
It looks like we're over the door.
And here I am, years later, following the astonishing story of the James Webb Space Telescope.
Nature has this way of being even more creative than we are. So we have always been surprised by what we see in the sky.
The first Hubble Deep Field actually came out when I was in high school. I already knew I wanted to be an astronomer, but I remember being just captivated by these images that were coming back from Hubble. it blew my mind to see that first deep field image, and that was sort of a, like, yep, this is what I want to do.
The earliest conception of Webb derived from the fact that Hubble took a deep field and didn't see newly formed galaxies after the birth of the universe.
It's sort of like we're missing that very first piece of the puzzle of how galaxies got their start.
Every time NASA builds a new telescope, it needs to be way more sensitive than anything we've ever built before. So every time you launch something, it was a new window on the universe. And so for Webb, we needed to build something that was 100 times more capable.
The main thing that Webb had to do to be successful was find these very first galaxies.
To look back in time to a part of space that we've never seen before and see the very first epoch of galaxies that were born after the Big Bang.
People think the Big Bang is a mystery because they think it's not what it is. The actual picture that we have as astronomers is the entire universe is expanding. The material is rushing apart from other material in a rather smooth, continuous way, while we see the galaxies rushing away from us. So what's going to make them rush apart? Well, something kicked them off that way. But since we imagine the universe is infinite, it has to be an infinitely large cause, whatever that is. So we just imagine running the movie backwards in our minds until it's different. So when you get farther enough back in time, the temperature, everything's mushed together. The galaxies are mushed together, the stars are mushed together, the atoms are mushed together, the atoms are torn apart into their constituent subatomic particles. So that's the movie you get if you run everything backwards. So then when you run out of imagining, you say, that's the Big Bang. So needless to say, astronomers have been imagining for a long time, what was this?
What would you call it if you could name it?
I just call it the expanding universe story. In Calvin and Hobbes, there was a different answer. Calvin called it the horrendous space kablooey. But that didn't catch.
And I now ask you to step forward to receive your Nobel Prizes from the hands of His Majesty, the King.
And it was March of 1996 when John Mather stopped in my office out here at Goddard and asked me if I'd like to work with him on a new telescope idea he was thinking about. And when John came by and said this, of course, this was before he had his Nobel Prize, but everybody knew, oh, asked you to work with him, you want to work with him. So I said, sure, that would be fun. I figured, well, I'd do that for a couple of years.
So, Dr. Smith, what is a next-generation space telescope?
Well, the NGST, or Next Generation Space Telescope, is the logical successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, or HST. NGST is designed to see the first stars and galaxies that light up in the universe.
And, well, here we are, you know, more than 25 years later. I'm still working on Webb.
Apollo 8, over.
Hello, Apollo 8.
Administrator O'Keefe renamed the Next Generation Space Telescope to the James Webb Space Telescope in honor of James Webb, who was the second administrator of NASA. So why name it after this guy? Well, James Webb was largely responsible for the success of the Apollo program.
We're going to have both science and technology appreciating your leadership in this field. I think this can be an asset, this program. I think in time, it's like a lot of things. It's sort of mid-journey and effort. But I think how we're making this trip for.
That's right.
But at the end of the thing, they may be glad we made it.
Yeah, this is Columbia on the high gate, over.
Roger, the EVA is progressing beautifully.
The Webb Telescope is kind of like my child, because I've been working on it since the first day that we started.
So when I started on Webb, my youngest son had just been born. Well, he's got a master's degree, works at Johns Hopkins, and he's gonna be 28. I had hair. I didn't need hearing aids or glasses. And it's a long time, but in hindsight, it's also a short time. We had this singular purpose for 25 years to make the James Webb Space Telescope a reality. And, you know, people did think we were nuts at first because the technical challenges were so daunting and the number of things we had to advance or literally invent were numerous.
I remember we had a draftsman who was able to draw what we said on a whiteboard, and we said we needed a big telescope with a big baffle, a big umbrella to protect it from the heat of the sun. So he drew this on the whiteboard, and we all said, yeah, that looks pretty good. We need something like that, and it's going to have to fold up. And we started talking about how to fold it up, and that was just the beginning, and we knew we were onto something.
In the early parts of the mission, we talk to the scientists, and we find out what's the scientific objectives of this mission. What do you want it to do, right? Then we put that into a language that engineers understand called requirements. How big does it have to be? What kind of sensitivity do you want? In other words, what's the dimmest thing you want to see?
The James Webb Observatory has three parts to it. The first part is the telescope and the science instruments. This has to be very, very cold.
It's designed to collect infrared light. So infrared is something that you cannot really see with your eyes. The Hubble telescope can see a little bit of it, but it's not cold. So the Hubble telescope glows and emits infrared light itself, so you cannot use it to do all of the things that astronomers have identified as their next top priority. This telescope is going to be in outer space. It's going to be cooled to a very low temperature of 45 degrees above absolute zero so that it does not glow.
There's one instrument in there called the MIRI that wants to be about 7 degrees Kelvin. And to put that in perspective, dry ice, carbon dioxide dry ice, is at about minus 109 degrees Fahrenheit. The second part is the spacecraft bus. And the spacecraft bus operates at room temperature, up here at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and it has the usual subsystems, the communication subsystem, the computer, the thrusters, the electrical power system. Then, between the two, is the third part, the sun shield. Five thin layers, about the size of a tennis court, that separate the hot side from the cold side. Five little layers that keep this thing in the shadows. And this umbrella, as you might call it, is no ordinary umbrella. On the hot side, 200,000 watts of solar radiation strikes it, and it can only allow 0.02 watts to get through. This umbrella is setting up an almost 600 degree Fahrenheit difference. And if it were suntan lotion, it would have an SPF of 10 million.
And it's going to have to fold up. And we started talking about how to fold it up. And it's got to be bigger than the Hubble telescope. And it's got to get way out there. And we can't get it there without a pretty big rocket. So what's the biggest one you can get? Well, it's not all that big. We're going to have to make a telescope that's much bigger than the Hubble and simultaneously much lighter. We ended up at half the mass and seven times the collecting area.
All 13,670 pounds, all 6 metric tons of this has to be launched 1 million miles out in outer space. And it has to fit into a fairing that's only about 5 meters in diameter, when the size of this sun shield is 21 meters in diameter. So to do that, we have to fold it up like origami so that it fits into here.
Pretty soon we know our job is pretty hard. Okay, gonna have lots of inventions along the way. So we made up a list of 10 inventions that we had to have pretty quickly. And we said, okay, world, tell us how you could make these inventions.
You have to keep in mind a lot of the technologies for Webb were new technologies, right? So you have a plan on how you're going to do it. And when you are testing it, lots of times something doesn't work. You have a schedule, a certain amount of time, and a certain amount of money.
Basically, people, although they don't quite say so, they think, your telescope looks weird. So our telescope does look different from every other telescope you've ever seen. It doesn't look like Galileo's little tube with a lens at each end. Way different from anything that we've ever built for anywhere before.
We're building a perfectly great telescope on the ground. We're aligning it on the ground. We're testing it on the ground. It's going to work perfectly, right? It's going to be great. Then what do? We bust it up. We fold it up. We put it into a launch vehicle. Then once we get it on orbit and it deploys, now we got to realign it on orbit remotely.
50 of the most complex deployments ever attempted robotically.
The telescope looks weird, but that's a matter of perspective. To me, it looks beautiful.
So that's your mission if you choose to accept it.
Yes, we had 344 single point failures, 295 of which were associated with deployment, almost all of which would have been mission ending.
So with Webb, we should probably go back to, you know, 1990 with the launch of the Hubble Space Telescope.
And liftoff of the Space Shuttle Discovery with the Hubble Space Telescope, our window on the universe.
NASA launches the Hubble Space Telescope, the biggest space science mission ever.
Discovery Houston, performance is nominal.
And shortly thereafter, it's discovered that its vision is blurry.
The conclusion we've come to from that is that there's a significant spherical aberration appears to be present in the optics.
I was devastated because I'd worked my entire career on Hubble at that point.
Congress had hearings. Hubble's the butt of late night TV jokes. And it becomes a major embarrassment and major black eye for the agency.
Although the surface of the mirror was perfectly smooth, the smoothest mirror ever made by humans on Earth, the trouble is it was too flat at the edges, about a millionth of an inch, which is less than the diameter of a human hair. But that was enough to cause the tremendously blurry images that we saw. My neighbors, who all used to be very, you know, happy and congratulating me on working at Hubble, they'd come up to me when I'm pushing my son around in the stroller and say, boy, it must be tough working on a national disaster.
We can characterize the problem, the spherical aberration problem, well enough that we can take advantage of an insurance policy that we haven't talked much about. And that is, we started a long time ago to plan a maintenance program. That is, every 3 years we plan to go up with the space shuttle, change out instruments, change out things that broke.
I come to NASA in 1991 as part of the team to help fix the Hubble Space Telescope. I end up leading a team that's developing corrective optics for the telescope. Astronauts install the corrective optics and a new updated camera.
It's completely awesome out here. A lot of work, but well worth it.
And after five EVAs, spacewalks, the astronauts came home, and about 2 weeks later, we took off the bandages from our eyes, and suddenly Hubble was fixed. It was totally fixed.
The most significant contact lens in American history. Over here is the picture taken after the servicing mission.
And it works beautifully, in fact, better than original requirements. And it's still working today as one of the most powerful instruments of science ever created.
This is one of the things about building JWST. We didn't have that luxury at L2, you know, where we couldn't service it. We knew that.
The L2 point is chosen for the Webb telescope because it's the first place where you can go where the Earth and the Sun are always in the same direction, and so you can put up your one-sided umbrella and protect your telescope, which you want to do either to keep the telescope cold, like the Webb. If you send it another few feet farther out, it'll eventually escape and go away from Earth. If you let it stay a few feet closer in, it'll fall back towards Earth and have some kind of interesting chaotic orbit. Anyway, you wouldn't like that. So it's the boundary between Earth orbit and solar orbit. And that's a good place.
We knew that this mission was going to require a number of test facility, production facilities and test facilities that didn't exist in the world.
Right from the very beginning, we were told to please develop an international partnership to construct the Webb telescope.
Webb is a global effort. NASA, ESA, CSA, and contractors all working together. It was 14 countries and more than 29 states all contributing to Webb.
You know, I always called it the giggle factor a little bit. Like, can we really do this?
This new telescope has, I think, about 64 megapixels.
You know, it's not like we could build and test things in those early days. So we were living in virtual land as far as computer simulations, computer modeling. You know, we had picked our architecture in late 2002. And obviously that's when things got really, really busy with trying to make this architecture feasible. Because I would say even at that point we were not quite sure it would all work at that time. It just seemed so far out.
Let's keep making progress on the telescope, because the more we get done, the better the chance that this thing will keep going as a program.
I think of the technologies, the ones that I remember were most challenging were developing the material for the primary mirrors. We had a big effort to determine what that material would be.
And it was a kind of exotic choice. We chose a material called beryllium, which is element number 4 in the periodic table. It's extremely stiff, extremely light.
It was the cryogenic properties of beryllium that really won out. You know, it's how stable it was at cold temperatures, and its thermal conductivity, how thermally stable things were.
When we mine the ore, we have to drill through and blast the rhyolite and remove that to get the volcanic ash layer where the beryllium is.
10,000 years ago, this was the bottom of Lake Bonneville, and millions of years ago, it was an ancient ocean.
So then it's pressed into this 550-pound block that's then machined out till it's about 50 pounds. Once that block is machined out to about 50 pounds, the backside is honeycombed. It's really cool looking. The front side gets polished. We're attaching motors to the back so the mirrors can actually move and flex up in space so they can align. Then what we do is we actually subtract off gravity. So we're building this in a place that has gravity. This telescope operates in space that has no gravity. The temperature change that happens between Earth and space actually deforms the mirror significantly.
You literally polish, you know, the wrong surface into a mirror so that when they cool down and they change their shape as they cool, it's the right surface.
And so we actually make the mirror less good on Earth so it can be more perfect in space.
We would then send them to Huntsville, Alabama, where we would test them at Marshall, and we would cool them down to these very cold temperatures and measure with a special test device how they change as they cool down.
Let's talk a little bit about those 18 iconic gold mirrors that are actually on this telescope. Amber, can you tell us about the science behind those mirrors?
So the reason the mirrors are gold in the first place is because gold is a good reflector of infrared light. So we've already talked about how Webb will view the universe in the infrared part of the spectrum. And that means it will see light that's just a little bit more red than visible light, than what your eyes can see. And so it turns out that gold reflects that type of light really well. So that's sort of the science behind why the mirror is gold.
So these are things that people don't realize it takes to get a telescope like the Webb telescope built.
But every week that went by, you know, we started getting questions of like, why is this taking so long? And is this going to go on for, you know, and there was a lot of pressure.
Okay, the Committee on Science, Space, and Technology come to order. The James Webb Space Telescope has been identified by the astrophysics community as its top priority.
There were voices out there. There was talk of, oh, let's cancel this thing. There was always a concern of mine personally from long before. We could end up like the superconducting supercollider, right? Don't want Webb to end up like that. You know, a really large science project ended up being too much and too long, and people lost the stomach to see it through.
Thank you for the question.
Congress got really worried about our Webb telescope and said, isn't that kind of crazy not to be able to service it? And the answer is, yeah, that's the only choice we had.
James Webb Space Telescope is another case study of NASA's mismanagement.
I know, this is a
how can we just
the original cars
I hope that we don't lose sight of why the United States is undertaking this complex mission in the first place.
If James Webb is fully funded, NASA will be on track to launch the largest and most powerful space observatory ever built.
The average person would be like, I couldn't, you know, bear the pressure and, you know, anxiety and stuff. And well, what's the secret?
How do you handle the pressure of something like this is an amazing question. I will say the bonds that we built through failure and then through success, of course, it was a family. We argued.
The position is the mom, mission operations manager, and, you know, it was, the job is kind of sometimes like being the mom for everybody. So everybody in here, you know, I almost, you know, you get to the point where you're almost personally putting them into the positions and you're kind of helping them grow into what's going to happen. You're trying to prepare them, you know, because I would tell people that it's it was a very stressful job as we got closer. And you had to kind of work with people to help them deal with the stress and stuff like that. So it was, you know, you tend to be a mom, be a good friend.
And we all knew the risks. You know, we all knew this wasn't a sure thing. None of us left. That's what I'm proud of.
First and foremost, we were ourselves. And we brought our strengths and we brought our colorful parts of ourselves. The way we survived, ultimately though, if I could attribute to one thing is, the more the naysayers came at us, the more we as a team bound together. If the naysayers thought they were gonna cancel this program by what they did, they only made us stronger.
In the early times, up until now practically, the budget was not what the project actually required. The budget was what people could get for us. And so it didn't change until Senator Mikulski wrote a letter and said, "We're tired of hearing from you guys. When are you going to tell us the real number?" She didn't say it in those words exactly, but please stop embarrassing us. So what's the real number?
2-1.
Senator?
Good morning, Goddard. How are we today? I am so happy to be here with you in the new year.
What led to us persisting were people like Senator Mikulski, who was a huge advocate for Webb and for NASA Goddard and for science in general. The science community was largely solidly behind Webb because they knew the potential this thing had and how important it was.
When we go into space, we don't go to conquer, we go to discover, new things about the universe.
We finish assembling it and ship it off to NASA.
We really don't know any much about it. We know that it was 18 pieces. We have pictures of what it was like. And get back. And that's about it. Everything else is sort of secretive. We just take it from point A to point B. Each mirror is worth about 20. And we have three in the trailer, so that's $60 million. And if we drove the truck thinking constantly that there were $60 million in the trailer, we'd probably just drive ourselves crazy and nervous wreck up here. We just have to treat it like everything else and drive it and do our job. Bye, guys. That new space mirror thing that we're carrying in the trailer, it's going to be a little over 1 million miles away. And we've driven 1.3 million on the last trip. So it's going to be really far, I can tell you. You know, because 1 million miles is a long time behind the wheel of a truck. So I can tell you 1 million miles far away is a long distance. It's real.
I've seen it. I've seen crates that the mirrors go in. I've seen the drawing of what the mirrors are gonna look like once it's put together.
You've got 18 of them all hooked together. So then you have to imagine that they're folding each one of these up and then they're opening all up at the same time. It's just like a flower. It's gonna be beautiful.
I have a little trouble sleeping knowing that these mirrors are on a truck crossing the country.
So these are the final three mirror segments for the James Webb Space Telescope. So yeah, an incredible milestone here today.
Worth getting up early for.
Absolutely, worth getting up early and standing here in the cold, sure.
These mirrors will literally see light from the first galaxies that were born in the universe. So, exciting stuff.
This is where we take all the VIPs that come through Goddard, so you guys are definitely VIPs.
Oh my God.
So yeah, this is the world's biggest clean room of its type. And if you look right up there, you'll see the familiar pods that have been on your truck over the last year.
They're gorgeous.
They are. They are. They're beautiful.
Remarkable.
And so this big yellow structure here is where we're going to assemble the mirrors onto the back plane of the telescope. So it'll sit flat, and then that robotic arm right over there will take all the mirrors and place them down on the back plane. So yeah, we have to keep everything clean so that once it gets out to the clean part of space, it's, you know, it's already clean. Mm-hmm.
It really is clean.
Yeah, and I mean, you see the guys in the bunny suits down here.
Wow.
So they have to stay protected. And that whole wall over here is air filters.
So I guess you can't smoke in there.
Can't eat definitely chicken wings not. In there.
No, no, no chicken wings
no
allowed
beer,
in the clean room.
No TVs.
Everything's so clean. Huh?
They're busy though.
This is just remarkable.
Yeah.
So when we watch this thing take off and we know that it's in space.
Oh, that's fine.
We were
there.
Yeah. We saw it.
It's a very tense scene in here when these two guys from L3 Harris were working over the primary mirror to take those covers off. They've been practicing for a couple weeks before this, but this is a very delicate procedure. Any misstep could damage the primary mirror. Even if they have a drop of sweat that falls off onto the mirror, that could set the mission back, 6 months or a year or so, because they're working to clean that.
At one point, they told us they needed silence. So a lot of us, including myself, just took a step back.
And this is something we really do not like to do on Webb or on any telescope, is be above the optics, having humans above the optics. So, and it's something that I've done quite a few times on Webb. The technician is on a diving board, which is attached to a forklift, is basically a harness platform attached to a forklift out over the primary mirror. And then physically removing a hard cover from each mirror segment. The mirror segments are within millimeters of each other, and so it's very difficult to remove something without scratching or damaging the optical surface. So it was a very delicate operation, and really just showed how careful we were gonna need to be.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful to see the instruments come into the clean room, being aligned. I think people know once we are on these chambers, it's a big effort to keep them cold. So we work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 3 months.
I mean, I knew that Webb was a really big deal because they were just putting the mirrors together when I got here. I mean, you can't not appreciate how it looks because it's huge and it's gold and it's beautiful and it's just so different from anything else. But one of my important life memories really was the first time going in the clean room. And there's something really special about putting on a bunny suit, especially for going in for work. Like, I never lost my appreciation of putting on a bunny suit, opening those doors, and seeing a space telescope in a room. Generally for the job, we are documenting what the engineers and the technicians are doing. And it's not typical for producers to come in overnight to shoot sort of glamour shots of something. So we got permission from the project to come in and give Webb a really special treatment with these shots. We got a lighting crew, cleaned a lot of gear into the clean room, and these really became some of the iconic shots of the telescope. I do think we got more embedded into a team than a lot of other media groups have. But yeah, you totally feel a part of the team when you are dressed like the rest of the team. And then you get to know your team from this lens. You know, there are some people that I only ever encountered in the clean room and was shocked to see what they actually looked like outside of the clean room.
So, Paul, go ahead and take us on a tour of the facility. And I might note, this is the same facility that for many years was used to develop the servicing hardware for the Hubble Space Telescope. So it's moving on to its next generation. Paul, it's all yours.
So there are our four instruments and the science instrument module itself.
Webb has four state-of-the-art science instruments and a guider. The instruments consist of a collection of high-resolution cameras that give you the pretty pictures, and spectrographs. And the spectrographs are the real scientific muscle behind James Webb. They're the ones that can tease out the signals that tells you the physics and the chemistry of the objects they're looking at.
Behind every image and spectra that we are seeing from Webb, our instrument has to work. So NASA asked the Canadian agency to contribute the fine guidance sensor. That instrument is one that looks for a particular star in the sky, what we call a guide star. Once it finds it, it keeps that position. The intent is to keep the observatory as stable as possible. If you want to take a picture with your camera and your camera is moving, that picture is not going to be good. So we do the same on orbit with this instrument that I look after, and that's a complex operation. I'm an astrophysicist, but I work as a systems engineer on the James Webb Space Telescope, in particular looking after two of the instruments, one of the science instruments and the instrument that guides the telescope to let it take all these pictures that we're seeing.
The system would not guide without Begun. She was the systems person for the guider, and it was such a complex thing to do guiding. There are so many technical details. She had her arms around all of it.
I don't know how we could have gotten through all of the complicated way to verify that Webb could point and track properly. That was a complicated thing to prove to ourselves that that was all going to work, and Begonia was key to that.
And what was great about her was she had this personality which was so positive.
Which is where you have it. That's
right. All right.
So I grew up in Spain. I did my degree there. Then I did my PhD in astrophysics in the UK. And then I think for family reasons, we ended up moving to Canada. And in there, I moved to the private sector, but to the space industry. So I started actually in Canada as the technical lead for the two instruments that were the contribution to this telescope from Canada. And of course, all these things are super careful. You have each instrument is built to meet what they need to do on orbit. Each of them has been tested to show that it can survive the worst part, the launch with the vibration and the noise, the acoustics. We had three of these tests on the chamber here at Goddard. The first one had two of the instruments, the Canadian and one of the European ones.
Good morning. I'm Chris Galise, director of the Goddard Space Flight Center. Welcome to the center. I'm standing in Building 29, and behind me is the clean room where we're building the James Webb Space Telescope. And as you can see behind me are the 18 mirrors that form the telescope. Now, so that you can start hearing about the telescope, I want to introduce John Mather.
Chris? Well, welcome to our science party here today. I think it's a wonderful day to celebrate, and I want to tell you a little bit about what we're doing it for. Today, we're celebrating the fact that our telescope is finished, and we're about to prove that it works. So that's a pretty important milestone for today.
When you're launching in a rocket, it's what we call random vibe. It's just random shaking, right? We did what we called a signed vibe test, which is essentially vibrate the thing at a given frequency.
Where we literally will shake the full telescope to simulate the effects of launch.
And then change the frequency slowly and watch how your system behaves. It's a much more stressing test. But that means that you have the possibility of over-testing certain parts. Certain parts resonate at certain frequencies. And when they start resonating and you go 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 vibrations, you start building up energy.
You start with a little shake, and then you go up and you shake it a little harder, and you shake it a little harder. There was a loud popping sound, and the sensors measured something that was exceeding the levels that we said, if this happens, automatically shut down. So we had an automatic shutdown. And I still very much remember because it happened on a Saturday, and I was actually home during that particular test, and I get a call, there's going to be a telecom. We just had an automatic shutdown, and there was a loud popping sound. And the popping sound gets your attention because you're not supposed to have a popping sound when you test flight hardware. And I literally drove into Goddard. You know, I'm like listening to the telecon and driving. And we started discussing whether that popping sound could be potentially, you know, something broke. The telescope was actually covered in this like plastic material and it's purged with dry gas. But you can see through the plastic material. So I literally climbed under the telescope with the phone in my ear, and I'm looking at it, and I said, you know, I don't see anything visibly broken, like nothing came off. And it was really difficult to figure out, but it turned out, you know, we started running a separate test of some of the launch restraint mechanisms and the systems that keep it latched up. And we found out what the problem was, which was at a certain level, these things started to chatter. And that chatter sounded like the popping sound that we heard. We call that gapping. We convinced ourselves that we were going to be okay for launch.
There is so much at stake. I mean, I love the drama of it all, but you have to understand that people's careers are made from something like this. And Webb was a mission that was going to be spectacular, whether that was good or bad, if it failed or was successful. It was going to always make history.
Everybody's pushing to accomplish something that's been outlined as an idea. The inspiration of trying to discover something, to build something that's never been built before, to discover something that's never been known before. It keeps us going, and we are pleased and privileged in our position here at NASA to be able to carry out this on behalf of the country and the world.
This center of curvature testing was in the main Goddard clean room, the largest clean room at Goddard, and it's a fantastic facility, but even that is at the limit of what we needed for Webb.
The telescope's optical segment, the part with the mirrors and the science instruments, was built at NASA Goddard in Greenbelt, Maryland, then packed and flown to the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas.
We needed a very large chamber to test Webb end-to-end optically. So we wound up using JSC Chamber A, which is the same vacuum chamber that was used to test the Apollo landers.
And it's been a long way, but we're here.
Chamber A was designed to test the Apollo Service and Command Module, so it had a rotating floor and a top and side solar simulator. So they would simulate the orbit of the traveling to the moon, where the passive thermal control system for the Apollo would rotate, kind of do what they call a barbecue roll, and practice its heating and cooling. And we did that with actual astronauts. It was before my time, so when I say we did that, I'm talking NASA, not me personally.
Didn't really get used very much. I believe there was a worry that, you know, that it might be mothballed or demoed, and they wanted to preserve it, and they made it a National Historic Landmark.
So Chamber A, with its 40-foot diameter door, is a pop culture icon. It's been in music videos like Aerosmith. It's been in Armageddon and Transformers 3.
Still working on the preps for Webb when we were trying to clean up the high bay for the movie Transformers 3. And they had to get permission from Webb to film that, so that as not to interfere with the schedule of the telescope. The Webb was really the most complicated thing that they had done since Apollo.
The goal of the test of the telescope in Chamber A really was to make sure everything was functioning properly at the very cold temperatures, and all the optical systems work properly at cold temperatures. It was the one time we could test the entire telescope at the very cold temperatures. The test was nominally a three-month test where we would cool the telescope down. It took almost a month to cool the telescope to this minus 400 degree Fahrenheit temperature. And then a little over a month, we'd stay at these very cold temperatures. And it was the first time we were going to test the full primary mirror as a mirror, because we'd only tested individual mirrors at that point. So we had to see that the shapes of all of them matched. It was the first time we were going to test the telescope, you know, sort of end to end. Most of the cooling that we do actually is done with a very large liquid nitrogen canister inside of the vacuum chamber. We run liquid nitrogen through it, and that cools us down to about 75 degrees above absolute zero. To get even colder, we'll have a liquid helium system inside of that, but most of the cooling capacity comes from the liquid nitrogen itself. The sequence of the test was it takes about 30 days to cool everything down. We had about 30 days planned for testing, and then about 30 days to warm everything up.
So when you are planning for one of these tests in a chamber, you always do the contingency procedures. If this goes wrong, what will I do? And I still remember our first meeting for Houston, where we go through all the things we can do if the chamber loses power, if this instrument doesn't work, whatever. And then they say, well, we also have to plan for a hurricane. And I remember being there saying, what? Are you kidding me?
We started hearing about a storm that was brewing, a tropical storm. And we all kind of gathered in a room. We started talking about contingency planning because we had thought a lot about potential for storms and hurricanes. And we did have a 5-day supply of liquid nitrogen in case there was ever a big storm. You know, we got ready. The storm got upgraded and upgraded and upgraded to Category 3 and Category 4.
So we were monitoring, and I remember finishing my shift, and the hurricane, it seemed that it was going to come. And we were like, well, what shall we do? And they said, we'll know, so don't worry, go home. I remember going for dinner with some colleagues. We went to the restaurant for dinner, and when we left, the water, you know, we were paddling on water. The water on the street was as high as the sidewalk. So that night, the hurricane hit.
And Saturday morning came, and, you know, the sky cleared a little bit, and we said, okay, well, it looks like we made it through the worst of it. Storm had kind of hit us. And so, you know, we had all these air mattresses and a couple people stayed there Friday night, but we actually started doing testing again. And, you know, Saturday afternoon, we got the very first measurement of the primary mirror. The very first time we saw the entire primary mirror was right after the hurricane hit the next day. But literally within an hour or two of getting those first measurements, several of us actually had gone out to dinner to kind of celebrate. We made it through it. And while we're there, we get an email from the meteorologist that it looks like the storm is kind of coming around in a spiral, and we're going to get a much, much bigger hit that Saturday night. You know, I think we got 51 inches of rain that week, but over 42 inches of it was in one night. And it was insane. And it was so intense that literally water started coming through the roof. So we started having to cover equipment.
I mean, you are there and you see the water come in, and then you see them coming and setting everything up. So we were just dealing with the day to day, you know. It was incredible to see, but at the same time, you know, we were just working and trying to accommodate all of this.
And it turned out that the storm lingered for a full 5 days. We had a 5-day supply of liquid nitrogen, but it was coming up on 5 days. And there was a point at which we would have had to do what's called an emergency warm-up and warm things up even faster than planned in a way that we had never done before in any of the rehearsals.
Pieces would have broken. You just can't have things change temperature that quickly when those kind of materials and expect them to survive.
If we couldn't get some liquid nitrogen, but the problem was the supplier of the liquid nitrogen was underwater.
It was a state of emergency was declared, and so getting our shipments of liquid nitrogen was not the priority of the state, and we had to make it happen.
The center did a great job of using our center resources to grab liquid nitrogen from every other point on the center and redumping it into our tanks.
And the teams, many of them slept in the control room. Hurricane Harvey was one of those times where the team gave up everything for the protection of the telescope.
We were literally at the very final day. I remember, you know, coming in really early in the morning. And after several hours, we finally got the president of the division that sort of ran the liquid nitrogen. And they were able to find a driver and find a truck and make a couple trucks of supply. And finally, they came that night. Or the next morning, I think we would have had to done an emergency warm-up and crossed our fingers a little bit. But they came, and I remember because we had a video camera of the place where the trucks would pull up. And when We saw the trucks. The entire control room broke into applause.
I was one of the first people in the chamber after when we opened it up. It was actually on my birthday. And it was one of the most powerful experiences of my time working on Webb. The chamber is amazing with the door shut. It's all black. It's designed to be not reflective for light. And so we went in with flashlights to do this inspection, and it's similar to spelunking. It's like going into a cave that has a space telescope in it. It is absolutely the coolest thing. We need to climb up on scaffolding to get to see the primary mirror. And so we went into the chamber and climb up on the scaffolding to take a look. And it was brilliant to see the gold mirrors against the black background in this chamber. Well, when I got past the beauty of seeing the gold mirrors again, they were absolutely filthy. So this was...
Why was that?
That was because of the fallout from the chamber. So during cryogenic testing, all of the particulate and everything that had collected inside the chamber for the last 50 years fell onto the exposed cup-up gold primary mirror segments. And so they were in pretty bad shape after the cryotesting.
A decision was made to clean the mirrors. And you look at multi-million dollar... beryllium, gold-coated beryllium mirrors. You're not using squeegee and some Windex.
So we rotated it so the gold primary mirror was cupped down. The big fear is that, especially on a coated optic, that through cleaning it, we're going to damage the coating or scratch the mirror or put some other substance on the mirror from what we're using to clean.
Larkin and his group from Ball went in a prone position with a very special kind of brush and IPA where they cleaned all of the primary and the secondary mirror with tiny little brush strokes. Maybe each stroke was a half an inch to an inch. And so it was incredibly detailed work that took a while.
I was within inches of the telescope for 10 days, and being under that gold-coated primary mirror there is something incredible to get to put the energy into cleaning that mirror and knowing that it's going to be receiving photons from stars and it's going to be helping to reveal the universe, and I get to spend time getting it prepared for that, cleaning it and putting it in the best configuration and the best condition it can be for what it's going to do in the future.
The other tough things when it comes to deployments are obviously the big, flexible, floppity things like the sun shield. Of all the deployments, that's the one that really is the toughest for many of us. Because the mirrors, just as an example, they are big, they have to work, but they're also very rigid, and we have a lot of experience with how to move big, rigid things and latch them in orbit. But the floppity things, the flexible things like membranes, making sure they go where you want, and more importantly, they don't go where you don't want them to go. That's tough.
How do I feel about the sun shield design? Boy, so here's the thing. I personally think that the sun shield design is very complicated. There are a lot of pulleys and cables and motors and drives. On the other hand, if you ask me, hey, go simplify the sun shield design, I would not know where to begin. It's I think, complicated by necessity. It's huge, and it has to be lightweight, and it has to deploy, and it has to deploy positively. We have to have tension on it. It can't be loose or floppy, and it has to stow and get folded. You bring in all of these constraints, and if you think about design as a space, right? You know, certain things cut off a giant portion of that space, and you bring in all these constraints, you're left with a relatively narrow box in which you can design. And, you know, because it exists, it's hard to imagine it being any other way. It's like your life, right? You grew up the way you are, and you are who you are because of the things that shape your existence. And so it's hard to say if you had a do-over, you'd be any different.
The sun shield is the key to the entire Webb Observatory. You know, it's the thing that blocks out the heat from the sun, the earth, and the moon from Webb's optics and instruments, allowing them to get down to those super cold temperatures necessary for them to operate.
There is not a book. There's no design standards. The sun shield is so novel that we can't find anything like that's been flown that has these crazy things it needs to do.
The sun shield turned out to be, I think, maybe a bigger challenge than some people thought, because, you know, although there were people experienced at deploying large things that have floppy elements to them, it's still a hard problem, and this was a unique sun shield.
And so we wanted to test out things like, you know, how do we actually just handle this material? It's very thin. There's five layers, and the thinnest layer is 1 mil, which is 1/1000th of an inch. So, you know, much thinner than your hair. We wanted to make sure we could just handle it without ripping it. If you ever try to fold origami, you know that paper can really only be folded a few times. It makes creases, there's lines.
The big thing with the sun shield early on was, how do we support it during launch? You know, it's floppy. You know, you got these five things that all fold up. You still have to hold it down for launch, or it'll sag, it'll move around and tear itself up, so you have to give it support. The launch environment's rather violent.
To hold the membrane down to the structure, you have to hold it down with some release devices, and there's 107 of them.
You can't even imagine the number of holes that had to be precisely located in these membranes. And then when you all fold it all up, all these holes have to line up. Oh, by the way, when it's deployed, these holes can't be such that sunshine can get through them lined up. So it's an incredibly complex problem geometrically.
Webb is massive. It is about 3 stories high and about the size of a tennis court.
Just try to imagine Roger Federer and Rafa running back and forth on their halves of our telescope. Just picture that and just imagine how large this is and what a hard job that is.
So NEA is a non-explosive actuator. So these are the types of release mechanisms that we use on Webb. The majority of our release mechanisms were all on the sun shield.
And we're going to skewer it, and we're going to pin it to this big structure. And then when we get on orbit, we'll retract those pins, and everything will be good. And I remember a meeting where we're like, yeah, that sounds like a really bad idea.
And I was actually out there doing my rotation one time when the head of integration test for Northrop was going to take me in the clean room to do an inspection. We're walking into the clean room. He says, I have to warn you, there might be a little bit of a hubbub in there. And I said, why is that? And he said, well, they found some screws and washers on the ground after this last test.
Every single one of those fasteners, 1,000 of them, when the screw goes through the end of the nut, it leaves a sharp edge. That sharp edge could catch a cable or scratch a 1/1000th of an inch thick membrane and punch a hole in it that could lead to an end of a mission.
You know, as you really dug into the issue, you know, it was a bit of a subtle interface thing. And one of the reasons you test things is to uncover these issues. But when you're a really large sun shield with a lot of screws and nuts and washers, you know, one small thing can multiply, and then it gets multiplied. You know, we were like in a goldfish tank. You know, the entire planet would read about it, be in newspapers. And you just knew that one was gonna be that kind of issue from the beginning. And so, I think that created a lot of stress for all of us.
That was a very big hit. It took about 11-month hit on our schedule.
Our architecture, especially in those deployments, had, what, 344 single point failures, right? If you're going to have 344 single point failures and they're all dependent on the last reset, on the last installation, you have to have an environment of absolute openness and honesty. And the fear that comes from the politics and that kind of stuff is your chief enemy to that.
I mean, it's crushing, right? The team is now sunk. It's out there in the news. You were getting less, and we now know we're not going to make our launch date again.
Mr. Bridenstine, welcome back.
Thank you.
You know, how much has changed since 1996?
Oh my!
When this was first put out there at $500 million, can you even talk about how much cosmology has changed?
It's a wonderful question, and when you think of the universe at large, NASA is learning new things every single day. How the universe is expanding, and not just expanding, but expanding at an ever-increasing rate. It's actually accelerating. And what is causing that? And can James Webb help us understand that, you know, at the edge of the universe, there are galaxies, in essence, disappearing because they're accelerating faster than the speed of light.
Wow.
So those galaxies, the light from them, if they're faster than the speed of light, that light can't get back to Earth, which means there's a whole lot of things we don't understand about the physics, astrophysics, that this particular spacecraft is going to help us learn. Going back to the very beginning of Cosmic Dawn, we're going to learn, how did the very first galaxies form? What did that first light look like?
I really want to thank you for the comprehensiveness of that answer, because the world and science itself is changing in ways that impact a project that we have completely different expectations for in 2018.
There's a whole host of capabilities that we can't even predict yet until it's on orbit, and we're doing everything we can to get there.
Mr. Chairman, I just wish we had a head of NASA that was excited about this project.
Yeah. Well, when you ask your first question, I could see that answer going on for a couple of hours, but I thought it was a good answer.
Outside of family and, you know, many other things, it's hard to imagine a prouder day in my life watching him. And got grilled and got challenged and gave honest answers and sat there and went through that and knew he, you know, he had to take it. And in the end, said, but we're going to get this right.
And for the first time, we are on the home stretch. When 2020 comes around and COVID hits. And at the time, it was like, you gotta be kidding me.
When people ask me what the biggest challenge on Webb was, I almost always say COVID. Now, we had technical issues and technical challenges, but people's health weren't being affected. Well, I think I'm saying, you know, mental health maybe got affected, but direct threats to your health did not come from that. This was a direct threat to our team. And to the most valuable resource of our team was the people. Not money, not schedule, nothing. It was the people.
Meanwhile, we're already wearing masks in the high bay. We were way in advance of that, right? Because if you look at all the old shots of Webb, and you're like, oh, look at them wearing masks. Was COVID back in 2011? It was like, no, we wore masks to keep the mirrors clean, right? So we already had mask practice down. And we said, let's keep going. So we kept a core team. That core team came in heroically, never stopped. And the team who never stopped, we all owe an incredible debt of gratitude for, because I tell you, if we had stopped, I don't know what it would have taken to restart.
There was just one last SunShield deployment test before Webb was packed up and sent to French Guiana.
This was going to be the last time Webb was deployed ever on the planet. And this was the culmination of the effort of thousands of people around the world. So I wanted to do something spectacular for this. And we got a gyro-stabilized camera system, and we mounted it underneath one of those lifts that they use in the clean room. And this lift can go up about 65 feet. And I believe during that time, we captured some of the most amazing images of the telescope in its final deployed state.
The last step as we were going through our deployments was removing that lens cap right before the SunShield was folded up. The instruments are very sensitive to light. They're designed to be extremely sensitive so they can sense far off faint stars. And so lights from the clean room could potentially damage these instruments. And so we had kept this cover in place not only for contamination to keep any sort of debris or small particulate out of the micro shutters, but also to optically protect the instruments from light that could potentially damage the sensors. This lens cap was removed at the last possible moment while we were stowing the four sun shield. And I was the one to do that. I'm a very even keel person and am able to perform these tasks in a really focused and relaxed way without letting my emotion be a part of it. And this one got me. This one was different. It was the last time that I would be in front of the mirrors in that way. It was the last time that I would see the inside the aft optics assembly, see the tertiary mirror and the fine steering mirror and the instruments. And so removing this cover, it was actually a pretty emotional moment for me. Was able to keep it together and not drip tears anywhere and get the cover off perfectly and get Webb ready to go, but it was a very emotionally impactful moment for me, saying goodbye to that part of Webb.
What's the one aspect of the design that you lose the most sleep over?
Ah, good question. I don't lose sleep over this. I did that already. I think what worries most people the most is that deployment. It's really hard to prove that it will do the same thing next time that it did last time. With the deployment, you fold it back up one last time, and then you push the button one last time, and it's got to be the same. So this is tricky. And the deployments cannot possibly be tested in exactly the same condition they will see in space. Zero gravity, cold, vacuum, we don't got that here. That's what I think most people worry about the most.
And the expectation is probably the hardest thing, I would say. The weight of knowing that this has to go right the first time and the only time, and there was really no room for error. Carrying that around for however long we've all been on the program was a thing. My boss, Jim, used to say that we're like deep sea fish under sort of constant pressure, and that once Webb was launched, we wouldn't really know what to do with ourselves because all the pressure would be off.
Webb is by far the largest piece of flight hardware that we've moved. The transporter is the largest transporter that I know of in history to come out of Goddard Space Flight Center. And essentially what STARS is a mobile clean room, moving JWST from one location to the other while it's still inside of a clean room environment.
And so it was goodbye for the entire team that had been a part of the observatory and spacecraft and integration and everything for 20 years at that point.
There was nothing easy about Webb at all. I don't care what aspect of the mission you looked at. So moving around that huge behemoth of a telescope became extraordinarily challenging.
The 405 is just something that is a big part of the heart of LA and that whole community, and so it was really neat that we got to send it right through the heart of LA and off to the sea in that way and be a part of that.
Going four times farther away than the moon over there, and it's going to be there for eternity.
Goodbye!
Goodbye! Goodbye. 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 Goodbye.
shipping the James Webb Space Telescope to its launch site in French Guiana. It just left port in the Naval Weapons Center, Seal Beach. And after 25 years of development, it's headed for its launch site and its final destination in space.
One of the interesting parts about when we departed is security. How did we make sure that we didn't encounter any sort of pirates or causing any disruption to our shipment? In the maritime industry, you can track ships everywhere they go. As we were departing from Seal Beach, there were posts on the internet because there is a vibrant community of people that are very interested in what's happening with JWST. And so on Reddit, actually, there was one particular person that was really good at tracking the ship, and he was giving a great log to the general public of where the ship was going. I was actually able to reach out to him, explain to him, you know, it would be great of him to maybe just add a little bit of vagueness to where the ship was actually going, the direction, just a little bit less detail. And surprisingly, he was great about it. You know, he went about posting and saying that, got a little bit more generic with the locations.
Bakuru is actually a good place for a launch site, very close to the equator, and that helps you getting an extra spin when you launch.
It was a bubble that we were there, mostly hidden from the pandemic, able to work and just focus on Webb and getting it ready for launch.
The weather's pretty volatile. I mean, you're in a tropical environment, even in December. In fact, caused one launch delay of a few days. Under the umbrella of that launch delay, no pun intended, the technical folks preparing Webb for rollout had a bit of extra time to be able to attend to last-minute preparations.
It was pouring. I got soaked more than I had any other time in Kourou. Standing out there with the team, watching it rolling out to the launch, and it is an absolute party in the rain.
We weren't going anyplace until Webb was off the ground safely on its way. So it's not like we had a plane to catch or a train to catch, right? We were a captive audience.
A really neat thing happened because of the way that launch had been delayed, and it ended up being on Christmas Day.
So when the clock hit 12, you know, it was a privilege of mine to wish everybody a happy holiday and to thank them and mention to them that their families were, you know, history had put them in that place at that time for a reason, you know. And I didn't go into it, but it was like, you know, I kept thinking about the Apollo 8 launch, you know, Christmas Eve, you know, reading about from the Book of Genesis. You know, it's famous, right?
That's now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, and God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
They're reading about, you know, the first light, and here we are launching this incredible machine that's intended to pick up that first light.
When the Webb telescope was launched, I was just sitting on the sofa with my wife because COVID was happening, so everybody stayed home. We didn't have any launch parties. Okay, well, that's how it goes. People thought, well, surely you must be on the edge of your chair because you've been working on this forever and it could go wrong. That's not how I felt. I felt, of course it's going to work. We've done everything we should do.
I haven't yet thought a lot about what is the proper Zen mode to get into for launch day. By that point, the die is already cast, right? Either we built it correctly and it's going to work, or we're going to find surprises on orbit, but it's time to go find out.
It's all looking very good here at the spaceport for a Christmas Day launch. Operations running smoothly, the countdown ticking over nicely. All the systems are green, and we are go for launch. We're looking at launch pad number 3, the James Webb Space Telescope, inside the very top of the rocket, in first class with its seatbelt on. I'm in the Mission Control Center here at the spaceport, the nerve center of operations. We're about 10 kilometers from that pad, and behind me you can see it's a laser focus here in the control center with the mission control centers all on console there as we get closer to launch.
Is it time to go to black? Take it away, Rob. It's all yours.
Merry Christmas from the Guiana Space Center
in Kourou, French Guiana.
You know, they do Ariane 5 launches frequently out of French Guiana, but there was something different about this one. There was something in the air that said, this has a different aura. This has a different importance. This one had a different flavor to it, and you knew you were in the middle of something big.
You get the 2-minute warning. Everyone goes out onto these balconies.
And you were watching a number of people, VIPs and invited guests, moving out to the observation platform that is right next to the Jupiter Control Center as we stand by for the 1-minute call from Jean-Luc Voyer.
À tous les idéaux, attention pour moins une minute. Top.
Thumbs up from Jean-Luc Voyer. All systems are go. We're inside a minute now. T-minus 50 seconds and counting.
And you wait. And you can hear a little speaker with Rob's commentary.
Turbo pumps will come up to flight speed for 7 seconds, and the command will be issued to ignite the solid rocket boosters. The James Webb Space Telescope will be on its way.
And then he starts counting down.
T-minus 30 seconds and counting.
By the time he got to 8, my throat was just closing.
Standing by for terminal count.
À tous de DDO, attention pour les décomptes final. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2,
out, you see it go, and it's going up and up and up and up. You don't hear it for at least 45 seconds to a minute. You know, all of my hopes and dreams and wishes and frankly, a piece of me launched at that time. And you see it go, and it's such a strange thing to only hear it. And it just rumbles.
And liftoff. Décollage, liftoff from a tropical rainforest to the edge of time itself. James Webb begins a voyage back to the birth of the universe.
It's a really specific, odd rumble that a rocket has leaving the atmosphere that also keeps it special in your memory because it's something that is very different than sounds that you hear any time else.
Just over a minute from now, springs will gently push Webb away from the upper stage of the Ariane 5.
There's this loop running in your brain where you're like, did that just really happen? You know, did we just really take off after multiple decades at this? Did we just really leave the Earth?
Separation Webb Space Telescope. Go Webb!
Ironically enough, as we marvel on this view from the upper stage camera, this will be humanity's last view
of the James Webb Space Telescope as it moves to its workplace about 1,000,000 miles away from Earth.
The launch team is done. Now all the attention turns to the operations centers.
For those of you who are just joining us, we are looking at live coverage of the deployment of the secondary mirror for the James Webb Space Telescope. You're looking at an animation that includes real-time telemetry, real-time data from the spacecraft as to the configuration that it's in.
We used to make jokes. It was like, you know, hey, you know, Merry Christmas. Look what we got. We got a telescope. Oh, some assembly required. Yeah, it was some assembly.
We start getting our deployment started, and Webb was performing beautifully.
You're seeing an animation, but this isn't just any random animation. This is actually based on real data.
That script looks good. You're go to execute.
Roger, executing.
Command will fire OTE LRM Group 5. OC, you're go to fire.
Copy, go to fire.
It's not just pushing buttons. There's a lot of real-time information that comes in, and you've got to be able to deal with it. You've got to assimilate it, figure out what to do, and make an action.
I'm getting more and more excited. My heart is starting to beat faster and faster. There's, for me, there's a tremendous amount of joy. I mean, I have this smile like on my face from ear to ear right now.
Again, we had rehearsed everything and practiced it a zillion times, but now you're up there and you only got one chance to get it right.
Without this mirror in its right position, we do not get light into the telescope.
Motor move has completed successfully, and depth lead has confirmed we are go to proceed with the latch to safe.
Roger, executing.
We are now at a point where we're about 600,000 miles from Earth, and we actually have a telescope. So congratulations to everybody.
Well, I'm thrilled to see that it finally works, because when we started off, we got a lot of people laughing at us that was impossibly difficult. And now it's done.
When we built the equipment, we drew our requirements up, they're all numbers. Nobody tells you what that means in terms of the beauty of the universe. Years and years ago, people asked me, John, are the pictures going to be beautiful? And I said yes, but I didn't know what they'd be like. So it was an act of faith, but it was a good act of faith.
Whatever's out there, we're going to see it. We haven't cranked this sucker up to 11, but we're going to.
When things got cold enough, the cameras worked. Saw those first images. It was like, yeah, this is pretty cool.
We're really, you know, standing on the backs of thousands of people over many, many different disciplines to make this happen.
The image came back. There was the beautiful center image of the star with six radiating rays of light, and there's supposed to be nothing behind it. Nothing. What we saw turned out to be 250 odd galaxies that have never been seen before in this image that supposedly had nothing in it.
There are galaxies everywhere. People said we've been photobombed by galaxies. So, well, that's a pretty big thrill for everybody.
I didn't know I was coming to a pep rally today.
But that's all the better. And you've got a lot to be rallying for. This morning, folks across this planet are going to see the images captured by this telescope. This telescope, because of infrared, is going to be able to penetrate through the dust clouds. You're going to see the formation of stars. You're going to see devouring black holes.
go.
We're gonna, let's do it. Okay, we've got the whole world watching. Are you ready to put the first image up? Oh, let's do it, let's do it.
We are ready to see Webb's first image of a star dying, a planetary nebula called the Southern Ring. Let's
see. Oh, wow.
Art that is out there in the sky, revealed for the first time. We're thinking of the team and we're thanking them. John, thanks to you, thanks to all of you.
I think people brought some champagne, so that's higher priority.
You're going to see things that this species has never seen. And you've done it. Tell everybody this was an important day in the history of humanity. Because we'll never look back. You can never undiscover, you can never unobserve things. So congratulations to the entire team. You've all made history. Be proud. And thank you for everything.
And, I'm a scientist, so I've been working on this project for 20 years, so we should expect what we saw, but no. Several times in the last 6 months, I nearly break my jaw of what I saw, these incredible images.
Success is binary. You either win or you don't. So we built something that was so ambitious. If it didn't work at all, we would be terrified. But if it did work, we would be guaranteed of tremendous discoveries. I think my favorite image is the picture of a cloud of galaxies with a very, very bright one in the center.
100 years ago, we thought there was only one galaxy. Now, the number is unlimited. And that light that you are seeing on one of those little specks has been traveling for over 13 billion years.
Everywhere we look at is going to be a scientific discovery. I believe that.
Yeah. Oh, no, I agree.
And every image is essentially a Hubble Deep Field.
Yeah.
Is that incredible or what?
This stunning vista of the cosmic cliffs of the Carina Nebula reveals new details about this vast stellar nursery. Today, for the first time, we're seeing brand new stars that were previously completely hidden from our view.
I present to you Maisie's Galaxy, which is named after my daughter, as we both discovered it on her 9th birthday, and she had been asking me for months to name a galaxy after her. I would like to leave you with one of my favorite images.
It's called Stefan's Quintet, and it's wondrous.
From the perspective of what we're going to find out, what do you tell a 7-year-old when she says, I get what the Curiosity thing's doing, but what's JWST going to do, Dad?
Ah, okay. She's got a good question. What we're actually trying to find out is the entire history of the universe from then till now, from the beginning till now. Including the things that made galaxies and stars and planets and Earth and made it possible for us to live on our particular little Earth. So that's why I'm interested. I asked my dad that question sort of like that, and I said, well, where did we come from? I was about 6 or 7 or something. Nobody knew. We knew a little bit, but we certainly couldn't tell you the whole story.
You know, we can get as geeky and as in the details as you want, but when you step back for a minute, it really is about our place in the universe. And that's something that resonates with people and that they hit people in an artistic and a spiritual way.
I'm reaching out to you from London.
My father was diagnosed last year with stage 4 cancer.
And unfortunately, the prognosis means he doesn't have a great deal of time left with us.
From as early as I can remember, my father has been out burning the midnight oil, looking at the stars through his telescope.
And often driving into the mountain overnight, setting up to take pictures and even submitting photos of what he found in magazines.
When I was a kid, I remember him upgrading his telescope every few years after saving away.
He is so passionate about the work you do, and the recent advancements of the JWST has been very exciting for him.
I'm really pleased he's still here to follow along with all the amazing innovation you and your team are doing at the moment.
He keeps busy keeping up with the news around your advancements. That's really cool.
For me, these letters express how I feel. These letters are about the wonder that I feel looking at the universe, the wonder that I feel looking at our team that made this observations and tool possible, astonishment at what we're able to discover.
It's kind of beyond words to describe how satisfying and fulfilling and rewarding it is after reading things like this. I mean, yeah, it's pretty hard to describe. It really makes you feel good about what you do, and to make a mark for good and for positive things in the world is pretty cool, pretty special.
That's actually why I do love space, and I think that other people love space, because it does give you that sense of awe and, like, feeling one with the universe. So I'm glad it helped someone.
Look, there aren't many things these days that almost everyone on planet Earth can feel inspired about. But I feel like the images from Webb are one of those things. They bring in a sense of wonder. It's kind of like when you're a little kid and you look up at the night sky. We need some wonder in our world. It's just a feeling of immense joy and achievement. And I feel happy for humanity a little bit, yeah.
So I'm lucky enough that I get to continue telling the story about what NASA's doing for its next big flagship missions.
There are plenty of other mysteries of science, but we are seeing with our own eyes, with the aid of telescopes, the process unfolding. So what more could you hope for from astronomy?
One of the core obligations we have is oversight. And we quite often hear in government how things don't work. I just want to say thank you for exceeding our expectations, and let's continue. And with that, I yield back.
So congratulations to everyone for making it happen, and we now are counting on continued brilliance for the next half a century, at least. Thank you for proving it's possible. Looking back to childhood, we had no idea. No one had any idea what the future would bring in terms of space exploration, new technology, electronics. It was all new. We had no idea that computers would ever be so powerful or so common. Marvels are yet to occur, and we are still growing rapidly in our capabilities. So astronomers have already a book that we outlined what we'd like to do for the next many decades. I think it'll take us a century before we run out of that book. And then from what we learn in the next decades, we'll have more miracles to produce, more miracles to ask for. So much is possible, and this is a very exciting time to be an astronomer.
I get to see things that are way beyond Earth because of where I work.
That will surely surprise us in some way that I can't tell you.
It's an exciting moment. This thing's been a long time in the making.
And once we get it out there, we got to robotically put it back together. That's never been done before.
Pride in humanity that when we want to, we can do that.
We're building this telescope really to answer fundamental questions that we have.
It's detecting the building blocks of life on exoplanets.
That then gets sent into the telescope.
All these galaxies in the background photobomb the pictures, right?
I feel like we're discovering new parts of the universe.
It's going to raw inspire us as people, or it's going to solve a problem we didn't know how to solve, because we're going to learn something that we didn't know until this big eyeball in the sky opened up and saw it. I don't know who else gets to say that.
The James Webb Space Telescope is the most ambitious and complex space science mission humanity has ever undertaken.
No one's ever done anything like this before. The science will be worth the wait.
Roger all, Discovery.
researchers were astonished to see the dust clouds annihilated when the massive stars exploded.
Now Webb takes us even deeper into the infrared universe.